Hello, Steve. How are you?
Robert, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Sorry it took us a few minutes to connect this morning.
That's okay.
All right. I'm speaking with Robert Siegel, the host of NPR's All Things Considered, who's retiring from that role this week. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for inviting me.
All right. Now, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the very idea of news that seems under attack right now. And it's, I think, more important than ever for us to help our audience understand the process of how news is made. So can I give an example?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Today, we're reading about a lot of interesting news that's showing up on the New York Times opinion pages. And what's the difference between a news that would show up as an editorial or as an op-ed versus something that was reported out by the New York Times' reporters?
Well, we assume that while a piece on the opinion page may honestly reflect the views of the person who's writing the opinion story, and we assume that that person has reconciled herself or himself to the facts, the New York Times does not offer that opinion piece as a statement of fact. The news pages, on the other hand, are reported as statements that have been corroborated. There should be a couple of sources for behind whatever is asserted in a news story, and if the assertion is controversial and much in dispute, there should be more sources than that. And it's different. We ask you, we say, look, you should you can believe what we tell you is the news. As for if you can agree or disagree with what someone's opinion is. But the news is all about it's all about facts.
Hmm. Are you worried that we're in a time when facts are mattering less than they used to?
Or the distinction is mattering less. You know, because what's happened with digital media is organizations that have made clear distinctions between pieces of opinion and news. Are those institutions, certainly newspapers, are disaggregated on the web, and very often the articles that make up, say, the paper are consumed without any regard for what department they come from. And I think a lot of people prefer the opinion pieces to the news stories. So, we need to have some regard for whether the crowd at the inauguration was indeed much bigger than it was 4 years ago, or whether it was smaller. It's not a fact that anyone is going to get sued over or go to jail for, but it's a basic statement of fact, and we should have some regard for facts and not just the feelings with which counterfactual arguments are presented.
All right. Well, thanks for helping us think about that a little bit.
I don't know if that was very helpful.
No,
Steve,
I think it was helpful to me. Now, in some other interviews, and I know we both probably feel this way, I've heard you talk about Susan Stamberg and her effect on you, on your career, on the difference that the voice that we hear. What do you hear in her voice that was different from the way people were talking on the radio when she first started?
I hear someone who is very conversational and informal and not trying to sound like some archetype of what a person on the radio is supposed to sound like. She was a breath of fresh air, and she was doing that really at the very moment when broadcast journalism in America started to have journalists who were conversing, who weren't just screwing up their face and looking at a camera and announcing blah, 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 you know, what the news was. That was changing. It was becoming more natural, the way in which people presented news, and Susan epitomized that breakthrough.
I
still does, actually. Yeah,
absolutely, she does. I like the fact that you could hear where she was from. She wasn't from some place over the mid-Atlantic in a plane trying not to be from any place. She was like, I understand you are like I am, from New York. And that was okay that someone on the radio was from New York.
Yes, that was dramatic.
It didn't used to be all right.
No, it didn't used to be all right to use that odd construction. And as I've talked about on the radio, talked about with Audie Cornish about this, mm-hmm. I grew up in an atmosphere where too strong a New York accent was considered a terrible way to speak. It was an important part of my upbringing.
Mm. Where in New York were you from originally? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Stuyvesant Town. Uh-huh. It's a very big, privately built housing project mm-hmm. along the East River, and it was built by Metropolitan Life for returning veterans from the Second World War. And I got to actually write the lead. I may get a word wrong here, but at some point I managed to write that my childhood home sold for $5 billion. because it was, when it was sold, it was the biggest residential real estate transaction in American history.
Wow. Where'd you go to high school?
Stuyvesant High School, which was a public high school for which you took an exam, and several hundred with the highest score on the exam got in. Mm-hmm. And in those days, it was just down the block from where I lived. It has since moved to a beautiful building down around Battery Park, and it was a great high school.
Can I ask you, who are some of the journalists that you've admired that maybe not from NPR that you plan to continue to listen to, or people in the past that you've really liked and respected?
Well, in the past, I liked and respected Daniel Shore a great deal, and then he turned out to be my colleague.
Yeah.
And I helped to get him to NPR twice.
Oh boy!
And he was both a colleague and a very dear friend. And I admired his guts, and I admired his persistence in covering stories in which the White House was as against him as anything today. That is, today we have a president who very publicly criticizes the media for engaging in fake news and then gives exclusive interviews to the very same institutions that he's criticizing all the time and clearly attaches enormous importance to the media. The Nixon White House really went after Dan. They started an FBI investigation of him and on the pretext that they wanted to hire him for a White House job, which was ridiculous.
Oh my goodness.
And Dan hung in there, and he was a good, smart, tough reporter who was a part of he was not part of the showbiz mentality that television news I think become more engaged with over the years. He was a tough reporter. Today, I in addition to listening to NPR, I think I'll read the New Yorker. I think I'll read the work of someone I know and admire, David Remnick, a great deal, and a terrific writer at the New Yorker. Many of them. Jane Mayer is a great reporter at the New Yorker. Evan Osnos, whose dad was a contemporary of mine in London, is a terrific writer. I'll read the New York Times every morning, both for the news pages and also for the columnists.
Okay, and I know they're going to want us to wrap up pretty soon. So, can I ask, is there going to be a Robert Siegel podcast?
I don't know if, as I told Terry Gross, I feel like I'm reliving. I recently interviewed a woman who wrote a book about the making of the movie The Graduate, which came out 50 years ago, and which I took my girlfriend to see 50 years ago as I was looking toward graduation a few months off. And here's a guy who's just out of college, and everyone's always asking, what are you going to do? And he has no idea, just as I have no idea.
Not going to be plastics?
It's not plastics. Today it's podcasts. That's what people do. People will come up to you and say, you got to do a podcast. So it's life repeating itself, just with a slightly different word.
Uh-huh. Well, Robert Siegel, I really appreciate your taking some time to talk to us today. And good luck with whatever it is, whether it's podcasts or plastics or just lounging around the beach. Thanks a lot for talking.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Steve. Thanks to you. Bye-bye.